This week, a cultural milestone, a turning of the page. Harry Potter dropped off the New York Times bestseller list. This next story is about a writer whose spooky tales may be the next big thing. Her name is Stephenie Meyer. The three books in her Twilight series have already sold more than 5 million copies in the U.S., and they dominate bestseller lists for kids' books. On Tuesday, Meyer released her first book for adults. It's called The Host. NPR's Lynn Neary brings us this report about Stephenie Meyer, a Mormon mother of three who's become publishing's latest phenomenon.
Before Stephenie Meyer even thought about being a writer, she loved the Harry Potter books. So she finds it bizarre when people call her the next J.K. Rowling. Still, she admits they do have something in common.
I think the reason why we get the comparison is because our fans are actually similar. They have that same fanatical thing going on. They dress up for the events. They come out early. They're just so into the characters. And I think that's why you get the comparison.
On Tuesday in Minneapolis, the day her new book, The Host, was released, about 1,000 of those devoted fans turned out to see Meyer at the gigantic Mall of America.
So I'm done with my questions. And now I have a lot of books to sign. I know you guys want to be able to go home.
If those screams sound like what you might hear at a Hannah Montana concert, that's because Meyer's fan base is mostly teenage girls. Ontaria Hester wouldn't let her 14-year-old skip school to see Meyer, so she stood in line instead.
My daughter loves her books. Every time a new book comes out, I'm at Barnes & Noble picking up the book. Every time.
Few writers can imagine this kind of commercial success. And what may be even more frustrating for those who write in obscurity is Meyer's insistence that she never set out to be a writer. The way she tells it, the Twilight series began with a dream about a vampire and a teenage girl. Meyer wanted to remember it, so she wrote it down and then began expanding on the story.
I didn't think of it as a book until the day it was finished. When I wrote the last sentence, I knew it was the last sentence. That's when I thought, wow, this is like as long as a book.
What did you think it was up until that time?
It was just this little hobby of mine where I had this story. To me, it was always just a story. And I enjoyed writing it so much that there really didn't need to be another purpose for it.
A devout Mormon, Meyer has built her empire around a story of adolescent desire. Bella, the young teenage heroine, falls in love with Edward, a vampire who refuses to drink human blood. But Edward must constantly fight his bloodlust for Bella. Time magazine described the sexual tension inherent in the story as the erotics of abstinence, a phrase that seems to embarrass Meyer.
It's really just my experience with the world and my experience with passion and the fact that when there is restraint involved, there's so much more to it. And I think that a lot of fiction and movies these days, they're really missing that beginning stage. They skip right past it.
At Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., a group of teenage fans of the Twilight series debate the relative merits of Edward the Vampire and Bella's other suitor, Jacob, a lovesick werewolf.
But why don't you like Edward? That confuses me. He's perfect.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not that I don't like Edward. It's just I don't like him as much as Jake.
That's crazy.
There's no question that this group, like most of Meyer's readers, have fallen hard for Edward. 14-year-old Jojo Emerson pretty much sums it up with this description.
He's the heartthrob boy vampire lead of the Twilight series, and I think just about everyone that has ever read it would perk up at the name Edward Cullen, even if they're standing like 12 miles away.
But the girls say you don't have to like vampires to like these stories. Naran Matty says that's because Meyer's vampires are different.
They're not, you know, crazy serial killer vampires. They're really nice, articulate, polite vampires with, like, table manners.
For these young readers, Meyer's books seem to be filling the vacuum left behind by the end of the Harry Potter series. 11-year-old Ellie Cohen and 14-year-old Jojo Emerson have both moved on in their own way.
Once I saw Twilight, you know, I started reading it, and then I put down my Harry Potter books. I was like, never mind about these. Sorry. I don't like J.K. Rowling anymore.
Actually, I am a purist, and I do not like to mix my Harry Potter and my Twilight. I have a pile next to my bed, and it's the 7 Harry Potter books, and I have the 3 Twilight books. I don't want to get those worlds mixed, because once I do, I know it's just going to go crazy.
If Jojo is worried about mixing up her imaginary worlds now, just wait till she reads Meyer's new book, The Host. Geared to the adult market, it's a science fiction romance where two women, one an alien from outer space, inhabit the same body and are in love with the same man. Meyer says writing dialogue for characters that share the same body wasn't a problem for her.
All of these characters in my other books, in this book, all of them take place in one head, mine. So I'm really used to internal conversations. That came pretty easily. I hear voices all the time.
And just as Meyer writes about good vampires in the Twilight books, she's created kinder, gentler alien invaders in The Host.
Some of my friends that read The Host when I was back and working on it in the rough draft stages told me, am I supposed to be rooting for the humans? Because I'm kind of not.
Meyer wants to attract an adult audience with her new book, but she also wants to keep her young fan base and hopes they'll give it a chance. 14-year-old Naran Matisse says Meyer has nothing to worry about.
I pretty much think she could write about a retirement community and we'd all read it. It's really, like, a given.
But Meyer does have one worry.
That they're going to pick it up and start flipping through it and be like, there's no Edward here. Where's Edward? And then they won't finish because they want more Edward.
Those young women who do want more Edward won't have long to wait. Breaking Dawn, the fourth book in the Twilight series, is due out in August with a first printing of 2.5 million books. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And you can read a chapter from Stephanie Meyer's new book, The Host, at npr.org/books.
The Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction has, in recent years, gone to some writers you might be familiar with, Philip Roth, E.L. Doctorow, John Updike. But tonight, in Washington, D.C., the prize will be accepted by a relative unknown, Kate Christensen. Her darkly comic novels about society's outsiders have delighted her fans, but have never received widespread acclaim until now. NPR's Robert Smith reports on what happens when a woman who writes about failure suddenly wins big.
When I go over to Kate Christensen's row house in the Greenpoint neighborhood of Brooklyn, I'm not terribly surprised when I find she's cooking this big green pot of soup.
Let's see what this is doing.
In her novels, the characters are always whipping something up to eat.
This is named after Saint-Germain, which is a suburb of Paris. Apparently they grew peas in their garden, so the name of it is lovely, Potage Saint-Germain.
It's the sort of simple meal with the pretentious name that would have been featured in her most recent novel, The Great Man. The book is the story of a dead painter and the remarkable trio of women he left behind, his wife, his mistress, his sister. They're all women in their 70s, all frustrated in some way, and they use food like a weapon to intimidate their rivals or seduce their lovers.
Writing the food was like writing dialogue, a way of revealing more of who they were. And then I made all the recipes, and they all turned out really well, I have to say.
Christensen is in her mid-40s. That she would even write a story of love and sex and revenge among 70-year-old women is quite an achievement.
I don't know that many books where the older women get to be the protagonists of the novel and get to have sex and get to be sexual and get to have opinions and say bad words and, you know, really just sort of strut around on the stage. And that's part of what made me want to write it.
Christensen delights in giving characters who live on the fringe their moment in the spotlight. In her first novel, In the Drink, her heroine was a 20-something underemployed drunk. The subject matter got Christensen labeled as just another chick-lit writer. So she started writing about male losers for a change. Her next novel was about a celebrity hanger-on who gets booted out of his cushy life. Her third book featured a misanthropic poet slowly trying to kill himself.
I'm really interested in people who are a little bit crabby and a little bit unfulfilled and have a lot to yearn for.
So you can imagine Christensen's reaction when the Penn Faulkner Foundation called to tell her she was a winner of a prize she didn't even know she was up for.
The Penn Faulkner, I mean, it's not the kind of award I even dreamed of winning. I didn't really think I was that kind of writer. Philip Roth and John Updike and Tobias Wolff, you notice they're all men.
Only four other women have won the award. And Christensen says she doesn't want to launch a feminist critique of the prize, but...
It's hard not to notice that men win more awards than women and are taken more seriously. But I also think women write more character-driven, on the whole, to generalize wildly, more character-driven fiction, and it's not taken as seriously as the show-off-y sort of stylistic tour de forces that men seem to write more of.
The judges of the Penn Faulkner Awards say that at least this year, they chose the novel that simply delighted them the most. Molly Giles was on the judging panel and says she just couldn't get the characters that Christensen created out of her head.
This was a pleasure to read about sophisticated, intelligent, honest, vain, sexual, older women. And I really liked the way that, as far as I can figure, Kate Christensen is a young woman, the way she evoked these characters.
The prospect of being an award-winning author does create a little bit of stress for Christensen. She says she's lived much of her life watching from the sidelines. When she was a child, she created this make-believe world that she could control. She wanted to be invisible so she could stare at other people. Now, when she accepts her prize tonight, everyone will be gawking at her.
It makes you vulnerable also to win an award. It's not just a pure thing. Before I won the award, nobody had ever heard of me, really. And so I felt like I was operating in a kind of safe anonymity. And writing these books about failed artists or somebody who doesn't have what they want. And those are the kind of people that appeal to me.
And not only did you get what you want, you got what you didn't even know you wanted.
I didn't even know I wanted it. I didn't even dream of it.
The book that won the Penn Faulkner Award, The Great Man, will be released in paperback next week. And luckily, Christensen says she's already finished her next book. It's called Trouble, and is about two successful and famous women who, no surprise here, have lives that are falling apart. In Christensen's world, even winners can be losers. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
When the credit crisis hit last year, the billionaire George Soros took himself out of semi-retirement. He'd focused less in recent years on making money and more on spending money to change the world. He had nonprofits and charities, and he was a major opponent of President Bush's re-election in 2004. But in 2007, Soros retook personal control of his investment funds.
It's the worst, most serious crisis of our lifetime.
George Soros says he's come out okay so far. But he considers the financial crisis a symptom of a much larger problem, and his voice is now added to our series of conversations about the economy. Soros offers his latest analysis in a book called The New Paradigm for Financial Markets. Essentially, he argues with a basic economic theory. He does not believe in the collective wisdom of the markets. Free market thinkers believe that when millions of people all make their own best decisions, all those actions add up to the best possible economy. That belief in the market is why the U.S. has reduced government regulation for decades. But George Soros contends there's a problem with this theory. People pass bad information to one another until the whole crowd makes bad choices.
The idea was that regulators always make mistakes. State interference in the markets just messes things up. And that was a false idea because the first part of it is correct. The regulators are human and bound to make mistakes. But markets are also human. And they are also bound to make mistakes. Instead of markets always being right, they're actually always groping at trying to find out what the facts are, but they never get it right.
Are you saying that in the same way that the housing market turned out to be overpriced, people were just paying more than things were worth, and now they're paying the penalty for that? Are you saying that America, as an investment, is overpriced?
No, I'm not saying that. I am saying that America has, in the last 25 years, sucked up the savings of the rest of the world and consumed it and issued a large number of IOUs. These IOUs are now held in the central banks of China and other Asian exporting countries, Japan also, and oil producers. And they're worried about it, that there's too much. They don't want to hold them anymore. And there isn't any good alternative to holding dollars. So actually they set up sovereign wealth funds.
That countries try to invest in different places.
That's right. And this is actually one of the factors that has fueled energy prices, commodity prices, and more recently food prices, which is actually setting up inflationary pressures at the same time as the country is on the verge of a recession. So you have a recession and inflation at the same time. That's why this crisis is different from the previous ones.
You know, when you talk about Americans spending so much money and so many dollars going overseas, in the shorter term, are Americans losing power as they accumulate more debt that they owe to people overseas?
Undoubtedly, wealth is power. As, for instance, China is becoming much more powerful than it was and is much more of a factor in the global economy. And they are now investing in Africa, in Asia. The once dominant role of the United States is now diminishing. And that is one of the factors why the value of the dollar as the undoubted reserve currency is now in question. Oil-producing countries now prefer to keep their reserves underground in the form of oil rather than to bring it out and convert it into holdings of dollars.
To the extent you can tell us, based on whatever information you publicly disclose, have you been betting on the dollar to keep going down or to go up at some point?
Well, basically, I've been negative on the dollar, although I think that in the near term, it may have gone too far. You see, the financial markets are full of uncertainty. They are much more uncertain than we think. Economics has been based on the model of natural science, but social events have a different structure because of the role thinking participants who can't base their decisions on knowledge, but have to have a certain bias.
Well, now, you're touching on something that's been discussed a lot in recent months. The phrase that's often thrown about is pricing risk. For example, if I'm a banker, how high an interest rate do I want to charge to allow for the possibility that some of my loans won't be paid back? And people realize that they were pricing risk too low, far too low, in recent months. That leads to this question, though. When you look at the markets today, do you think that people are still underpricing risk, still too optimistic about the odds of success in most investments?
That happens to be my view of the market, but of course I may be wrong also. Just because I have this different theory, it doesn't mean that I'm right, because what I'm saying is that we are all wrong, and that includes me. But I do think we have now passed through the acute phase of the credit crunch, and markets are currently breathing a sigh of relief. But the fallout in the real world, in the real economy, is yet to be felt, and that is not yet actually reflected in the markets. So I am actually more pessimistic about the stock market than the market itself.
Well, if regulation of the markets doesn't work so well because human beings, human regulators screw up, and if the markets don't necessarily work so well because they're also run by humans who collectively screw up, what answer is left other than short selling a lot of stock?
No, I think financial markets are very, very flexible. They can adjust to changing circumstances. The fact that they are imperfect should not push us to abandon or constrain markets too much. We have gone overboard abandoning regulation. We mustn't go overboard abandoning markets. So while I see the dangers, I also am basically optimistic that we can learn and we can understand things better.
The new book from George Soros is called The New Paradigm for Financial Markets. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
And you can read an excerpt from his book, The New Paradigm for Financial Markets, at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Here's an idea for saving endangered species. Slice them up and slap them on the grill. That's the premise behind a new book, Restoring America's Food Traditions, Saving and Savoring the Continent's Most Endangered Foods. We stopped by the local farmers market to test out the idea.
So, if a species is endangered, you should eat it.
No, you shouldn't do that.
Probably not.
I can't imagine eating a koala bear or something like that.
Sounds crazy, say Tom Hubrick, and before that, Heather and Landon Godsey. But it just might work. Conservation scientist Gary Nabhan edited the new book.
Well, for heirloom seeds and heritage livestock breeds, yes. For wild species, it may be a couple generations before we see them on our plates again, but we want to engage people in their recovery and their habitat restoration, and by reminding people that these foods have been an important part of the historic dietary of America, we think we can motivate people besides self-described environmentalists to play a part in this conservation.
It's an idea that makes sense to Eric Rice of Country Pleasures Farm in Middletown, Maryland. He grows a rare species of apple called the black twig.
By eating it, you can actually develop a demand for it. And if you develop a demand for it, then more people will grow it. And so there's something to be said for that.
That's right. A lot of wonderful flavors have fallen off our kitchen table because they've lost market demand, a lot of them because they couldn't be shipped all the way across the country. So if we create local market demand for these, if we take these place-based heritage foods and make them the pride of our festivals and fairs and Thanksgivings and picnics again, they will come back from the brink of extinction and be available not just as part of our biodiversity, but part of our culinary heritage again.
Gary Nabhan's book is loaded with recipes using things you've never heard of. The black sphinx date, the northern giant cabbage, and the Tennessee fainting goat.
The Tennessee fainting goat looks as if it has just seen Elvis and swooned. But in fact, it has wonderful meat characteristics for barbecue. But it was on the brink of extinction, and now people in Tennessee and Texas and surrounding states are bringing it back.
What's it taste like?
Well, it depends how you fix it. You can't fix these heritage breeds, these meats, as if they're a frozen Angus steak. The best chefs in the country are experimenting with them. And for example, I've had the mule foot hog cooked by Kurt Fries of Iowa City, Iowa. It was the best pork I have ever had, hands down.
Sounds great for dinner on the town, but it's not great news for those of us without celebrity chefs at home. At the local farmers market, we find out something else. There's a reason why producers go with more conventional breeds. Take egg seller Tom Hubrick. He loves his Golden Comet chickens.
They're always on time, they're always cheery, and they don't call in sick. So how much better does it get? You know, so if I do have to negotiate with them, it's very simple. It's either my way or your soup.
But, Hubrick says, a more obscure heritage breed wouldn't do him much good.
They don't lay a large egg. You know, the biggest is a medium egg. So, and most people want large or extra large eggs.
At another stall here, Corey Childs sells mutton and lamb from his farm in Virginia. It is a boutique operation. The sheep are grass-fed and, he says, humanely raised. But they're not a heritage breed. He says those take too long to raise.
The longer it takes you to get an animal from birth to market ready, the longer it takes you to get any return on your investment. So that's usually the downside. The plus side to it is normally they have more flavor in some cases.
Your mouth watering yet? Gary Nabhan says start looking for heritage foods locally.
Many of them can still be found in farmers markets across the country, but just in 3 or 4 farmers markets. Some can now be found on the internet through Local Harvest, a website that lists all of the rare foods of exquisite flavor that can be sustainably harvested, and indeed find out how to direct order these foods from the farmers and fishers that offer them still.
So remember that black twig apple? It's dark red, almost like a plum. It's a great storage apple, says Eric Rice.
They are an old southern variety of apple from the mid-1800s, and that a few folks have worked to save the trees, and so they are now available. And we've been using them now to make stewed apples with calvados.
Calvados?
Oh, calvados is the step beyond apple brandy.
Oh, it's
spectacular would be the word. Born for cider. There's no question it's born for cider. It's probably the reason it survived in that part of the world, since the mountains of southern Appalachia is known for a lot of things, not the least of which was being able to make alcohol out of a lot of things.
There are more rare foods and recipes from Gary Nabhan's book, Renewing America's Food Traditions, at our website, npr.org/books. Check out the recipe for crow bison cattail stew and Mission Wine Punch.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.